conguero, band leader, and arranger Poncho Sanchez with Afro Blue. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lee. It is Friday, May the 31st, and Americans have lost about $16 trillion in assets in the recession from 2007 to 2009, and have been able to recover only about 45% of that so far, says a Federal Reserve report. More on that later in the program. But first, a look at America's new ruling class. And our guest tells us exactly who that is. Our guest is Joel Kotkin, a distinguished presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University in Orange, California, a contributing editor to the City Journal in New York, a senior visiting fellow at the Civil Service College in Singapore, and a fellow at the National Chamber Foundation, a highly respected speaker and futurist. He consults for many leading economic development organizations, private companies, regions, and cities. He also serves as executive editor of the website NewGeography.com. His most recent book, The Next 100 Million, America in 2050, published by Penguin Press, explores how the nation will evolve in the next four decades. New Geography, The New Geography, How the Digital Revolution is Reshaping the American Landscape, and Tribes, How Race, Religion, and Identity Determine Success in the New Global Economy, are also books that he has written. And I am so delighted and feel very honored to have you as our guest today, Joel Kotkin.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I enjoyed, and it was an extraordinary way in which you presented the information about these new oligarchs that America has, and you pinned them as tech gurus. Why do you consider them new oligarchs?
Well, what you're seeing is, in a funny way, as we've seen with the whole erosion of income equality in the United States and, you know, particularly the pressure on the middle class, but we are seeing something very similar to what we saw in the late part of the 19th century and early 20th, which is, as we've had a technological change and a change in the nature of our economy, those who have, if you will, seized the high ground in that have accumulated enormous wealth, and very much in the way that, let's say, a Henry Ford or a Andrew Carnegie or a John D. Rockefeller did. But oddly enough, this group of people, basically from the digital side of the economy, you know, many of the wealthiest people, many of the youngest wealthiest people as well, have market shares in their areas of 50, 60, 70%, you know, what we would consider monopolistic, are now beginning to gain, you know, considerable political power as well. And so I think there's kind of a romanticism of the Silicon Valley entrepreneur as sort of this, the rugged individual, and it's going to be the, salvation of the economy. But in reality, they are not so different from, an oil company. I mean, they're seeking maximum profits. They're going to try to pay as little in taxes as they humanly can. And if they can access cheap labor from abroad, either bringing it here or using it there, they're going to do so. I'm just suggesting that we look at the tech oligarchs in the same way we would look at oligarchs in general.
Now, I just want to get a differentiation between the oligarchs and the plutocrats, because you talked about both of them. Now,
okay.
so could you differentiate who are the oligarchs and who are the plutocrats?
Well, I think, I would say the tech oligarchs are different from the plutocrats, and the plutocrats are just people with enormous amounts of money. And, that's been your kind of Wall Street. A lot of it's Wall Street, a lot of it's inherited money. The tech oligarchs are people, really a class that has emerged in the last 30 or 40 years. We've had plutocrats for a long time. And their power is in some ways greater now than it was in the past. But this is a new group, and they're concentrated in one particular sector of the economy, again, characterized by an extreme geographic concentration. In other words, they're basically in one, and to some extent, maybe two regions of the country, basically the San Francisco Bay Area and the Seattle area, the San Francisco Bay Area being much larger. And they also have they have a different sense of themselves. I mean, they themselves do not see themselves as plutocrats or as, you know, sort of a new kind of ruling class in the sense that the money is new, the style is casual. You don't have, you know, the country club kind of environment that you might have had around more traditional industries. So they see themselves as sort of creating the economic future of the country, in a way that I don't think, you know, oil and manufacturing and warehousing and home building industries and agribusiness see themselves. I don't think they have quite the same sort of messianic self-image.
I think a really interesting way of getting a sense of how powerful this new group is taking a look at something we've been discussing on this program, and that is the so-called immigration reform.
Yeah.
I've taken the position that it really is a way of, it looks like a something that is supposed to help people, but when you really take a look at it, it is using, and I accused the Obama administration of racializing immigration to put the Mexican face on it, but really serving as a ruse to get a lot of interesting things happening on the back end that would benefit, for example, the tech industry and other industries, bringing in workers who will be paid at lower wages, and at the same time, stalling this so-called path to citizenship for Mexican Americans by 13 years, as many as 13 years. How does this illustrate the point that you're making about the tech gurus?
Well, the tech people obviously are not particularly concerned about, you know, illegal immigration from Mexico. That's not an issue all high on their priority list. I mean, except that they may want to keep them around to, you know, to work in their homes. But this is a very specific issue, which is bringing in IT workers. I have to say, it's very complicated. But from what I've gathered, I've looked at the recent Economic Policy Institute study. I've also spoken to, actually this morning, with people on the same issue who are working on this from the tech sector. And there's clearly a desire to bring in large numbers of workers without even asking the question if the American market serves them. My understanding on the ground is that, yes, there's always going to be a shortage at the very high end. And there's also, by the way, a shortage in the technician ranks, let's say connected to manufacturing or energy, where you need people with technical skills, you know, maybe a two-year education. But it appears that we do not have the kind of shortage of IT professionals, information technology professionals, that is being widely claimed, and that we are graduating many IT students from American universities, and many of them are finding it very difficult to find work in the tech field per se. And so there really is an interesting question is, if we have skills shortages, are they in the areas that the tech people claim they are, or are they somewhere else?
But it seems to me that the tech people, especially through their lobbying groups, have had an extraordinary impact. They literally almost have guided the writing of the legislation itself.
Well, I think we will remember the Obama administration as much as anything as being the time in which the tech oligarchs, if you will, really began to consolidate political power in a way that was not evident before. And part of that is that Obama has alienated large parts of the traditional business community, so they're not supporting him, and also that there's been this huge run up of wealth in the tech community. I mean, all you got to do is watch any kind of sports event and it's one phone against another, one operating system, whether it's Apple or Android or these toys now dominate our lives. And I think part of it is, frankly, that they and things like Facebook are substitutes for material progress. We essentially indulge this sort of interior world, which doesn't necessarily have a huge effect on the overall economy, but is nevertheless part of why, for instance, when Steve Jobs died, Occupy people had moments of silence for him. Now, Jobs was, a brilliant entrepreneur and obviously did some very good things, but to act as if he wasn't the 0.0001% was sort of absurd. And obviously, as we now know, he has a company that has paid very little in taxes and has been associated with some pretty horrendous violations in their manufacturing operations in China. So we just need to look at these people clearly instead of seeing them as, they're the good rich as opposed to the, let's say, the traditional bad rich.
The issue of Jobs, could you tell us, just by comparing it, say, to the auto industry, could you tell us what the comparison is with the number of jobs that one would assume that the tech industry would actually generate in the United States compared to the auto industry?
Well, the auto industry is, numerous times more people. And, of course, one very important fact is it employs a lot of people who are not highly educated, which is a group that, that type of employment is very important for. The tech industry is not a huge job generator. It's basically the information sector has lost about 1 million jobs since 2001. Silicon Valley is still 40,000 jobs below where it was in 2001. And the new wave of tech companies, more software oriented and social media oriented, simply don't have the sort of industrial employment, let's say, that a semiconductor company might have. And if they do have blue collar and middle skilled jobs, they tend to be located certainly outside of California and most likely overseas. So the job generation is just not there. Plus the old tech boom, let's say the tech boom of the 90s, that brought jobs to Sacramento, it brought jobs to Oakland, it brought jobs and employment to people, let's say, in the Central Valley. This is doing very little of that. This is increasingly both foreign, very young people, very highly skilled people. And so the impact on the broad 80-90% of the American population is really not so great compared to previous tech booms, and certainly compared to the industrial boom of the past.
But when you noted in your recent article that about 700,000 people work on Apple's physical products for subcontractors, but very few of those jobs are in the United States, that's huge.
It is huge. And I think that, if General Motors moved all its production to China, I don't think people would feel a great deal of loyalty to General Motors. Somehow we've come to this point of view that we don't really care about middle income and working class people. We celebrate the sort of, the hip, cool professional, and we really are not, we really don't hold these tech companies to any kind of standard when it comes to a whole series of issues, labor, diversity, and certainly issues that relate to what are the environmental effects of what they do in the other countries, because obviously in China the controls are much less. and also on the issue of privacy. I mean, what we're seeing now is an attempt by some of the tech companies to generally get control of the entire information infrastructure of the U.S. so that everything about you or me that we do, that we think we're doing privately on the internet, is going to be bundled and sold to advertisers by a handful of companies. I mean, for instance, that's one reason why I'm not on Facebook. My kids are, but I'm not, because, you know, any kind of mechanism that's there to check, you know, where am I right now? What am I doing? No, people are stupidly, I think, giving up all their personal data on these networks, which then is being resold to all sorts of other people. But I think that that's a particular danger, because when you think about it, if these are the mechanisms of transmitting information, and they're also the mechanisms for finding information about individuals, and a small handful of companies have the control over that, you know, you sort of have a outsourced big brother, if you will.
Mm-hmm. On a psychological level, is it that we this new group of people have so transformed our society as a whole, globally, has so transformed the world and how we live in it and how we interact with it, that in a way it is a kind of fear of this group that didn't accompany, say, the rise of the old oligarchs, you know, that, where we just saw them as people wanting to make a lot of money. Here there's an added factor about people who have forged a brand new way, didn't exist before, and therefore they are the owners of an extraordinary amount of knowledge, and knowledge equals power, and power equals the right to rule and the right to dominate our society. So we acquiesce in deference to the knowledge that they supposedly have and that we don't have.
I think that certainly there's some truth to that. I mean, let me put it this way. You know, people knew that Carnegie or Ford or Rockefeller were, you know, probably pretty ruthless people, and they were definitely interested in making money and all that. I think people, particularly the progressives, obviously understood that they also had too much power and had to be brought in. This time, a good part of the so-called progressive community is really hand in glove with these very same people. And, you know, that's a real change. And part of it is, I think the psychological is really quite good, because you think about young people today who are struggling to find jobs, even people with education, and certainly finding good jobs. But they're, you know, their heads are buried in Facebook, in their cell phones, you know, playing games, you know, video games. And these become sort of the substitutes for life. I've had students who spend 4, 5, 6 hours on Facebook a day, or 4, 5, 6 hours doing video games. You know, think about, you know, sort of bread and you know, sort of electronic bread and circuses. So basically what you do is you make your life an open book. You tell you let Facebook or Google have all your information. And by the way, you don't even benefit from selling your own information. And meanwhile, you sort of, you know, see these people as being, you know, sort of a good force. And you're right. There is this sort of Daniel Bell called it the priests of the machine. They know the secret, you know, just like in the Middle Ages, the priests were the only ones who were literate. So they sort of knew what was actually in the Bible. Well, in some senses, this is a similar development, where these are the people who actually know this sort of alchemy of how to build all the wonderful toys that consume our lives. And so that gives them a special power that I think we may never have seen quite in the same way before.
And this power is all over the place all at the same time. It used to be that the power sometimes was, you know, concentrated, let's say, in Congress, or concentrated in a particular industrial field.
Right.
The way technology has evolved now, it's everywhere. So the power is exerted everywhere. And so they become, even though they're young and they look disarmingly harmless and they look, they take the care to do public things that align them with progressive ideas and movements into the greening of the earth and all of this stuff. But they're really very, very ruthless characters. And
right.
they're about making serious money. And I suspect, again, on the psychological level, much of what they're relishing is the way that they so easily now have access literally to the world, to world leadership. They are looked at as leaders by leaders.
Right. No, and they have a kind of almost, almost semi-mystical sort of power and are regarded in that manner. And I think that this gives them something very, very unique. And also because, remember, it is social media, it is a media form itself, that gives them control over the flow of information. When you think about it, every day there are 110 million people on the Yahoo website. So what Yahoo decides to, and I've been on the site and I've been on their television show as well, so I have nothing against them, and I happen to be my homepage too. But 110 million people. I mean, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, are nothing compared to this. And when you realize that the next generation will be getting the vast majority of its information via these conduits, the power is going to be even greater. And then you look at, let's say, in the entertainment field, you have the... a Netflix or Amazon moving into books, into television, into movies, because again they have that channel. You think about Amazon, how many both online and regular businesses have essentially disappeared as a result as things have been consolidated at Amazon. So again, you have this massive consolidation of both money and power and influence. And I think that third part, influences, may be the most important, as you were pointing out, because they are both the medium and the message.
Mm. Wow.
And they can shape views. I mean, this is one of the things I've been telling the conservatives. I said, the fact that the tech industry is basically with Obama was an impossible barrier for the Republicans in the last election. They just couldn't communicate to a whole new generation of people.
Speaking of Obama, let's take a look at his two terms, now in the second term, of course, but how has the Obama administration accommodated the rise of these new oligarchs?
Well, of course, there's been the one thing, obviously, on privacy legislation. They've basically taken their party line and backed it up. Second thing is obviously on this immigration issue. They've basically been backing them up. They have been basically allowed the tech companies to do things here that, at least in Europe, they're discussing whether they're the limits on privacy and market share. At least those issues are being discussed in Europe. They're not even being discussed here. And he's been great cover for the tech industry because he's still to many people very attractive figure. Has a very strong base. In academia and in the minority communities and among women and among gays. And so affiliating with Obama also gives you a kind of aura. But I think what Obama has done is he's been very, very effective in helping the power groups that have been behind him. And by sort of the the policy of helping what I would call the gentry class, which really has been very strongly supportive of him. Now some of those things that he's supported, like let's say gay marriage, I think have broad support, particularly among younger people, and I think are very positive. But we have to look at the economic underpinning. And economically, the Obama administration has actually been quite terrible for the middle and working classes in this country. Now, I'm not saying the Bush administration was any better, but I think there was certainly more hope that Obama would do more to help, sort of blue collar America, and that promise was not so well realized.
Well, you've been tracking the footprints of power and influence for 30 years. You are a futurist. You're a person who specializes in kind of predicting where things will go, and you've done that on a global level. Have we arrived at a point where we can say with certainty that we have entered the virtual age, going from, of course, the agricultural age to the industrial age to the information age to the point where now people like Zuckerberg and others have created the possibility, the real possibility, that geographic physical space is not necessary anymore. They can actually have a virtual nation.
Well, I would look at it in two ways. One, I do think that there is a kind of community, if you will, that is transnational. You certainly see it when you work in a place like Singapore, where a lot of money from around the world, some technology, some trading interests, accountants and international law firms really operate on a completely global basis, and they have very limited loyalty to any one place. Okay, so that's certainly happening. But the great irony is that despite the sort of transition to the information age and even to a virtual age, real stuff still matters. And when you look at where money and power originate and where wealth is being created, a lot of it is still in agriculture, energy, manufacturing. I mean, if you look at the rise of China, it's been driven by that. If you look at the relative health of the Australian and Canadian economies and parts of the United States, it's still basically a resource economy. So we've got this kind of dichotomy. People still need energy, they still have to eat food, and they still consume products that are tangible.
So, well, of course, now I saw recently the advent of 3D food, where you would be able to print your own food. You will get cartridges of flavored substances, and you can concoct a bunch of meals as you wish, and then you print your food.
I think we're a long way from that being a way of life or being, but certainly
this is food. I would say it is.
Obviously everything can be, technology can change the nature and the cost. I mean, technology has played a big role, but I do think that the tangible economy is still very important. And that's part of the conflict that we see. I mean, I think, very much the way Marx described the conflicts during the period of Louis Napoleon, you have a one sort of old ruling class, tied to one set of industries, and an emerging new ruling class tied to another set of industries, and that these are now in conflict. And the question is how...
Your metal tower has been...
Oh, are you there? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, yes, good.
Yes. So, I mean, I think I think we're in the midst of that conflict, and I think the Obama administration certainly represents the first real triumph of this new oligarchy, the first time they've really tasted power and they've really integrated with a very strong political group around Obama. I'm not sure the story is over. We don't know what will happen after this. Because the big problem is that although it has been very good for the oligarchs, it hasn't been so great for the vast majority of the middle and working class.
Who should we be watching? In terms of this oligarchy, who should we be watching?
Well, I think we should keep an eye out on all the new lobbying efforts that are in Washington. Companies like Google now have very big presence in Washington. Certainly Google would be a big one. Microsoft would be a big one. Apple would be a big one. Those would all be companies that I would be looking at. Facebook, of course. Again, we have to understand that these are people who are also making huge amounts of money very young in life. They can do an awful lot of mischief if you want. If you've got $20 billion, I mean, look at a guy like Michael Bloomberg. He bought a whole city.
It's true. It's absolutely true.
And particularly, Bloomberg is an interesting exemplar of this new kind of oligarchy, because where does his money come from? It comes from a kind of a media information company, a classic. And that's one of the reasons why, whereas many times very wealthy people don't do so well when they run for office, Romney being the most recent example, because they're kind of cloddish and they don't really understand how to project in the media and all that. But a guy like Bloomberg, he's surrounded by media professionals. And he has the money to pay off or somehow satisfy people who might otherwise be in conflict with him. And I think we're going to see this, a group of people who are very, very good at projecting a good media image. And what's interesting is it's very different than the old generation of techies who were actually kind of, in some ways, in some sort of, because I've been covering this for a long time, who, were actually kind of, they were nerds. They were like guys with the plastic pen holders,
pocket protectors.
Right. I mean, but in a funny way, they weren't very slick and they weren't very elite. They were, a lot of them graduated from San Jose State or Purdue or the South Dakota School of Mines. And they sort of were awkward in communication. Now you've got a group of people who are much more savvy and much more media centric than the old engineering types. And that makes them even more powerful and even more potentially dangerous.
You've written your most recent book, The Next 100 Million, talking about how the nation will evolve over the next four decades. What is the vision there?
Well, I mean, I think that there is a lot of things that are very positive about the United States. I mean, we still have relatively good demographics, although that's getting a little shakier. We do have enormous natural resources, food, energy, that make us very unique relative to our biggest competitors. And we have a culture that's been changeable. So I mean, as much as I think we have to worry about this class, at least, if they're dangerous, at least there are dangerous people. I mean, the rest of the world is simply being colonized by these people. So they have no influence at all. So, I mean, the country is, very flexible. I think we are going to see some degree of change where people are going to start to challenge this sort of unprecedented invasion into people's privacy. And Americans are they're pretty innovative, and I'm hoping that eventually people will begin to say, okay, I don't really want to do Facebook. I'm going to do something else, because this something else is more, I have more control over it. I'm more protected from invasions of privacy. So, I mean, I'm basically reasonably optimistic about the United States. I think our biggest issue is going to be the issue of inequality, lack of, and more to the point, the lack of social mobility and the concentration of wealth and power. But those are classic American issues.
I can't resist the urge to ask you to kind of delve into your other book, Tribes, because you just mentioned the key word there, inequality. What is the conflation between race, religion, and identity in determining success in the new global economy?
Well, I mean, the point of that book, and it's something I've been studying, and obviously in East Asia is quite evident, is the link between sort of culture, family, identity, and success as a, which has been, very critical if you look at the evolution of East Asia in the last 30 or 40 years. So when we look at America's future, we have to start to look at it as, what kind of culture do we have? How strong are our families? How do we deal with the very basic issues of infrastructure? But also, the issue of what are our values? What matters? What doesn't matter? And are we committed to the next generation, or are we just sort of saying, okay, we're going to have our time, and then, who cares what happens afterwards? And that's a very big issue if you want to talk about for the American tribe, because, we're a very individualistic people, which has been our source of strength. But on the other hand, I think if we neglect the idea that we are in a sort of situation where we have to take care of other members of the tribe, if you will, and we have to look at how they can be more self-sufficient, I think that's an area where we've been falling down a bit.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us today, Joel Kotkin. And I really want to also ask you for the privilege of a rain check for a return visit.
Sure.
This has been very, very informative. Besides you, who are some of the people keeping tabs on these new oligarchs?
Well, I think EPI has done some very good work on the issue of immigration. That would be one place to look.
Is that the Economic Policy Institute?
Yes.
Okay.
In Washington, I think there are in the article in the Daily Beast, there are references to other articles, which I think if somebody's interested, if you just go to the Daily Beast and pick up, or newgeography.com and pick up the Tech Oligarchs piece, you'll find references and lots of places you can go if you're interested in understanding this. But it's really a kind of new field that there hasn't been an enormous amount of work. A lot of the work we had to do on our own, like by going into, all sorts of, original data, we just did, there hadn't been as much work as one might think in understanding this process.
I really do thank you so much for being with us today.
Okay, well,
this has
my
been
pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
We'll take a break and come back with some interesting news from the Fed right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Beatrice Lead, and a very interesting story that was published yesterday evening. And I want to bring your attention to it because we are hearing all this news about how things are getting so much better. The economy is getting better, or housing starts are rising, or housing purchases are rising. And this report issued by the Federal Reserve is saying something quite different. And I just thought I would read it to you. The headline says, Americans have rebuilt less than half of wealth lost to the recession. American households have rebuilt less than half of the wealth lost during the recession, leaving them without the spending power to fuel a robust economic recovery, according to a new analysis from the Federal Reserve. From the peak of the boom to the bottom of the bust, from 2007 to 2009, households watched a total of $16 trillion in wealth disappear amid sinking stock prices and the rubble of the real estate market. Since then, Americans have only been able to recapture 45% of that amount on average, after adjusting for inflation and population growth, according to the report from the St. Louis Fed on Thursday. In addition, the report showed most of the improvement was due to gains in the stock market, which primarily benefit wealthy families. That means the recovery for other households has been even weaker. A conclusion that the financial damage of the crisis and recession largely has been repaired is not justified, the report said. I'll skip a couple of paragraphs and go on. The report found that the most fragile households were not well-educated, relatively young, or black, or Hispanic, or some combination of those characteristics. Those families tended to have low savings, combined with high debt, and accrued much of their wealth through housing. How those households respond to the changes in wealth is a critical component of the recovery. Top officials, including Chairman Ben S. Bernanke, have pointed to the rebound in real estate and the soaring stock market as evidence of the success of the central bank's policies. All right, that's enough to get a good picture. What they're saying is, don't believe the hype. What they're also saying is, the rich are getting richer and have gotten richer. The poor are really up against the wall. Now, this is yet another of probably hundreds of reminders by now to President Obama that the African American and Latino communities, but the African American community specifically, is experiencing catastrophic economic fallout. This is year 5, and this president has yet to come up with something of a plan that addresses the issue of unemployment, of job creation, of actual jobs. I read you recently the statistic that from the Business Hour on the PBS, that the economic expert on that program estimated that among teenagers, unemployment was well over 40%. And, you know, that's an extremely conservative figure. If you are in the communities often enough, you know that the unemployment rate among African-American teenagers is probably in the 80th percentile or 90th percentile. It is atrocious, and unemployment rates for African Americans, the rate is the highest it has been since the Great Depression of the 1920s. This is outrageous. We still have some time for your calls at 888-874-4888. This is an institution, the financial institution, that is underscoring for the umpteenth time the same story that we heard. We heard it here from the Economic Policy Institute. We heard it from the Cato Institute. We heard it from economists. We heard right here on this program, we've been discussing this issue of unemployment at catastrophic rates for African Americans and Latinos, but African American unemployment rate is disastrous. And this president is busy running around the country raising money for the Democratic Party because Nancy Pelosi has to be returned as leader of the House, he says. And that is the priority item. We just finished talking with an internationally respected person who has been observing trends in politics. And he says, this administration, he can't remember any other administration that has so cozied up to oligarchs, and he's using the word, people, a very tiny group of people who have amassed incredible amounts of power and influence. This administration is catering to that group of people. This administration has used the votes of working at class and working poor people to basically accommodate the whims of the rich. Chris from Queens, hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Utrice. Good afternoon.
Hello.
I loved your guest. I'm sorry, I didn't get his last name.
Kotkin, K-O-T-K-I-N.
Okay, because I tuned in a little late. I loved the discussion, and I absolutely agree that you need to have several more interviews with him because it was a really fascinating subject. I think with the enamored deification that we've applied to the technology, which I'm not undermining, you know, the importance and the good part of it, I think that years from now we might look back and find that we've thrown some babies away with the bathwater. And because he mentioned a few things that I thought were really very important. I'm not sure what I want to comment on because there were so many things that he touched on that I thought were important. But, you know, one of the things he said about that, you know, these the new technology that keeps on coming out every other week, and, you know, that there's essentially toys that dominate our lives. Mm-hmm. And what has happened, you know, talking about this new class of very young techies like Zuckerberg and, you know, who makes billions. What is he, a billionaire now?
Well, he's worth $9 billion okay. and counting.
I apologize. I mean, he's not even 30 years old yet, or maybe he just turned 30. I'm not sure what the, you know.
He's 32.
Okay. The thing is that I'm very dichotomized over the way that Americans have, and it's not just Americans, it's all over the world, but it seems to me that a group of people, you know, it's like when you go into the hospital and they take your pulse because they want to cure you of the illness, and they take, you know, they took the pulse of Americans because it essentially started here, if I'm not mistaken, the technology, you know, the advancement of it at such a fast pace in the last 15 years. I mean, it has existed for years, but to the degree that it, the changes that have taken place and the jump forward in the last decade has been absolutely huge. And they take your pulse and they realize where you're coming from, you know. And the American, I mean, since we live in this country, I'm going to comment on this country here first. They take the pulse of the American and all of these little toys and the convenience that is so essential to American life. And, you know, it's kind of like when somebody gives you this drug, or I don't know what analogy one wants to use, that you say, oh, this is a bomb. And so you kind of resort to it, and you go to it more and more often because it makes it easier for you to cope with your life. And the thing is that it's almost like at one level, I'm kind of jumping around. It's kind of like the fox has now entered the hen house. The fox is supposed to guard the hen house. What they've done is they've used technology, because he mentioned about American individualism, which is a word that I heard yesterday on a program as well. And I have a problem with that, a characterization of today's American, and I'll tell you why. They've used technology, a lot of these big investment banks, and when you're talking about the economy, that were able to get away with a lot of what they got away with, okay? Because if you go back to the decade of the 80s, the technology existed, but you didn't have the kind of access to these, you know, high-frequency trading and all of these other things that is essentially available only to those high-end people in places like Goldman Sachs and the rest of these big banks, these multinational banks. And what they've done is they've used technology to, as much as I can understand it, I'm not in finance, I've tried to study it on my own because it's so complicated, but technology has been used to the detriment of a lot of people, not only in this country, but all over the world, so that these high-end people, who are basically, some of them, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be negative, are basically missing a human chip. There's something that is
well, you
there's
know,
nothing missing from them in this respect. They've used the technology because your guest also mentioned, I think, at one point about, you were talking about about virtual reality, which was brilliant. What they've done, for example, like a lot of, you know, when they sold all of these products to, let's say, the European countries and the other banks that were also involved in it as well, but it started here, and they sold all of these products knowing full well that they were selling them a lot of rotten apples in these batches watches that they sold. And what happened was is that they spread, because the way these things work with all of the, you know, the high frequency bets, a lot of these bets were not, and the speculators were, it was not backed by real money, from what I understand. In other words, that they would bet on a product, for example, and they didn't have backing. You know who explained this very well?
We're kind of running close on time, Chris.
I'm sorry.
So you want to bring it home, as they say.
Yeah, they bet on all of these products, and they used a virtual reality to do it. That's what I'm saying. So basically, a lot of what they were using was not there at their disposal. They just used it because of the technology, you know. And that I wanted to say that because a lot of this technology that's being shoved down our throat, I think that, with all of its positive aspects, I think that we're losing, you know, our sense of personal privacy.
Well, that was the point that Joel was making as well. But the main thing, too, that I wanted him to address, and he did it so well, was that these new rulers, because that's what they are, they have hegemony over this sector. And they are ruthless, they are ridiculously wealthy, they are not employing as many people as you would think in the United States. They are they literally authored the immigration bill. The immigration bill was agreed to in the Senate committee only after input from the lobbyists working in behalf of the technological sector. And as I said, the only jobs, all of the jobs are not going to be only the tech sector, but that's who has authored or played a major role and influenced the authoring of this bill. So we see how they have ensconced themselves in the legislative process, and they are de facto rulers of the world. So we have to watch that. I want to remind folks that we have a little piece of work to do, and that is to encourage the Department of Homeland Security to activate and expedite the Haitian family reunification now. We have a lot of kids who are suffering and dying in Haiti because these visas that have been approved for them to be joined with their families here in the United States simply have been on the waiting list for almost 3 years. So please do call Congresswoman Frederica Wilson at 202-225-4506 and politely ask her to urge the president to have the Department of Homeland Security expedite the Haitian family reunification now. Thanks so much. And thank you very much for being with me today. I really hope that you enjoyed the program and it started you thinking about certain things, about how power is wielded right in front of your eyes, and it's made to look like something else. You know, these are made to look like really nice, well-meaning people, and they're so progressive and everything. But you look beneath all of that, and you see that they did put the old-fashioned capitalists to shame. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Thank you, and have a pleasant weekend. We'll see each other again on Monday. Thanks so much.